Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're going to start out with a couple of work sessions, but I want to notify everyone that Senate Bill 180 is not ready to go, so we will carry Senate Bill 180 over to Thursday's Finance and Revenue Committee meeting. So at this time, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 182. Mezzan.
Whoops.
You thought we were doing the hearing first?
Yes.
I thought Mezzan was kind of branching out here for a minute, but sorry for the confusion, Chris. Well,
Madam Chair, I was trying to encourage Mezzan to branch out.
Well, you know, I think corporate taxation is way too exciting to limit to just one person.
I agree. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 182 adopts a uniform definition of a financial institution and replaces the definitions currently in statute. It's effective for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009 and applies to tax years that are subject to appeal, adjustment, audit, or refund for certain entities. And you have a dash one amendment in your packet that essentially just replaces the word organization with institution.
Okay.
Throughout the statute.
All right. Department of Revenue, want to add anything to this? Deborah?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. The Senate Bill 182 was first heard in February 3rd, for a public hearing. And at that time, I asked the committee to delay work on this while we were continuing to work with the Multi-State Tax Commission on whether the uniform definition would be changed by the commission. They've completed that work. That definition is not changing at this time. So our suggestion would be that you consider going ahead with the bill. The reason we suggested the amendment is to make a small change. Instead of using the term financial organization, it would be replaced with financial institution. But just to refresh your memory about the purpose of the bill, we have two definitions of financial organizations or institutions that are in the statute now. One goes back to the time that financials were taxed at a different rate than other types of corporations. So we had a different definition. And then also we have a definition for purposes of apportionment. And neither of those definitions conform to what is in the uniform proposal that the Multi-State Tax Commission has. So this would eliminate the definition that's no longer needed and then adopt a uniform definition for financial organization, financial institutions.
Okay, and why was it important to change the word organization to institution?
Madam Chair, it's just to be more consistent with the uniform language. It's not intended to be any substantive change. It's just that in their proposal, they use the words financial institution rather than financial organization. And we have both terms used in our statutes. Some statutes use financial organization. Others use financial institution. This would bring consistency to those terms.
Okie dokie. Any questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The definitions, because excise tax and income tax for corporations are two totally different things, this change does not affect the taxability of the institution at all, does it?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I don't believe it does affect the taxability of the institution. This should not change the determination of whether a corporation is subject to tax in the first place. What it does change, or has the potential to change, is which rules of apportionment is the corporation required to follow. Does it file under the provisions of the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, UDIPA, which is non-financials, or does it follow the apportionment rules for financials? But it should not change the subjectivity.
Okay, so what I'm gathering is that financials still are treated differently from other corporations.
Madam Chair, that's right. Financials use the apportionment and allocation rules under ORS 314-280.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you, Deborah. Anything to add, Chris?
I would point out that you do have a revenue impact statement, and it's a minimal because the change in which rules would apply. I'm not expecting to be much of a revenue impact, so I have that as between a loss of $50,000 a biennium or a gain of $50,000 a biennium somewhere. There could, depending on the characteristics of the firms involved, it could go either way.
Okay, so what would cause it to go up and what would cause it to go down?
That might be a good question for Deborah.
Come back.
It depends on the rules that surround the information that go into the apportionment family.
Okay, it is very minimal, but just for curiosity, what factors would cause it to go down a tiny bit or up a tiny bit?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. You could have a corporation using the factors that apply to non-financials, and in the numerator and the denominator of that calculation, there could be things that are included or excluded for that determination that are the reverse for financials. So it's what goes into the numerator, what goes into the denominator, and differences under those two different sets of apportionment rules could result in increases for some or decreases.
Senator Telfer.
Well, then, following up on the question I just asked, there is a possibility that this definition change will affect the way somebody pays tax.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, perhaps I misunderstood the question you asked. What I answered was whether the corporation would be subject to tax in the first place. That is, do they have to pay tax? Do they have to determine whether or not they owe tax? And this bill should not change that. What could change is the actual calculation of the tax because the apportionment factor may be slightly different for a non-financial corporation versus a financial corporation, financial institution.
And right now they're filing under as non-financial? They're filing under the same criteria as non-financial?
Madam Chair, if the company doesn't meet the definition of a financial, then it follows the rules that apply to regular corporations. Mm-hmm. If they are a financial, they follow the rules that apply to financials. So some corporations could shift from being non-financials to financials.
Oh, from these definitions?
Yes, Madam Chair, which means they then use a different set of apportionment rules. But it doesn't change, should not change in my mind, whether or not they're subject to tax in the first place. That is, are they doing business in Oregon? Mm-hmm. That would be the test. Are they doing business in Oregon? If they are doing business in Oregon, which set of apportionment rules do they use? Those that apply to a regular corporation or those that apply to a financial institution?
Okay. Senator Telfer.
I'm going to follow up to the chair's question. What would be an example of somebody who files in Oregon anyway because of the source? How would they all of a sudden have a higher tax because of the apportionment calculation?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, we think that there could be credit card companies that are not included in the definition of financials now that would be filing under the rules that apply to a regular corporation, that is the UDITPA rules. In the determination of what's taxable to Oregon, the things that go into the numerator and the denominator for the credit card company may be different under the UDITPA rules than they would be under the financial organization apportionment rules. So the credit card company would be subject to tax in Oregon regardless. The question is, which apportionment rules do they follow? And this, if they're not financials under current law, but this changes them to being defined as financials, they would shift from the regular apportionment rules to the financial organization apportionment rules.
Okay. All right. Fascinating. Okay, any other questions? Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Morris, we have a -1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 182.
Senator Morris has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 182. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 182 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 182 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Telfer.
Well, I thought you were going to hit that before, and I was going to catch you before
on objection.
I'm uneasy because of the explanation as to what the increase in tax to certain entities would be. I didn't get a clear comfort zone on really are there various and how many going to be paying more tax on this with this supposed just a technical change in terminology, which is obviously causing certain entities to pay more in tax.
Or less.
Or less. But I don't have a good sense as to why and how much.
Okay. Chris, can you offer any help on that?
I don't have the number of potentially affected. I could do some more research and try to get a handle on the number of them in conversations with the Department of Revenue. My understanding was, I don't know, I can't speak for the Department of Revenue, but I don't know that they have any detail on the number of firms that might be affected or to the extent they might be affected, and that's where it's being viewed as a technical correction. And so in the world of possible thinking through, well, if their company has these parameters, then they might be affected this way, which is why the revenue impact says what it does rather than an absolute no impact, which is, in my mind, at least more definitive, saying if we put a no revenue impact on it, there's no way it can have a revenue impact. And here it's allowing for, well, if such a company exists and have such parameters, they might change a little bit.
As I recall, we did not have any testimony from the financial institutions. Is that correct? Financial institutions, we did not have any testimony. Senator Telfer, and I have to assume that if there were any concerns, we would have heard about them.
I appreciate that there's apparently some unintended consequences, and I don't know that we have a clear handle on what those unintended consequences are or will be. Kind of took a stab at it that, yeah, it could be 50,000 more, could be 50,000 left. We don't know. There's apt to be somebody affected. So just a little.
Okay. All right. Would you like a roll call vote?
Sure.
Okay. Let's call the roll.
Senator Hatt?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Senator Telfer?
No.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye. Okay. Senator Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this?
Yes. I'd be happy to.
Okay. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 609.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 609 creates rebuttable presumption. You have a dash one amendment in front of you, or a dash two. If you have a dash one, ignore it. And the bill as drafted would create a rebuttable presumption in proceedings before magistrate or tax court judge that disclosure of confidential business records would cause harm to the taxpayer and would require the court to weigh the potential harm that could be caused against any public benefit and allows for the decision of the magistrate or court judge to be appealed. That's what the bill as drafted does. What the amendments do, they remove the rebuttable presumption of harm and they change the requirement that the magistrate stay the case on merits to a permissive language and requires.
Okay. I think people at AOI worked very constructively on this. Did we have Deborah, did you want to add anything to this? John, why don't you come on up too? This is your...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. We very much appreciate the opportunity to work with Mr. Marshall on the amendments for the bill. We think they work, the dash two work just fine, and are happy to turn over the microphone.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And we, too, appreciate the work of both John and Deborah from the Department of Revenue, Darren and Marilyn from the Department of Justice, and Bruce Miller from the State Court Administrator saw the original amendments and had some concerns. We have allayed those concerns, and we're very happy with the Dash 2 amendments and would encourage your support.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, if I could, perhaps when the bill moves through the process, we could change the name of the requester from Association of Oregon Industries to Associated Oregon Industries.
Oh, I can't believe we did that, Mr. Marshall. Tell me it's not true.
I'm afraid so.
We will
Thank
make
you.
Sure that gets corrected.
Thank you very
My
much.
Apologies.
Or you could just change your name.
Okay. Senator Morris, we have a Dash 2 amendment to this.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 609.
Senator Morris has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 609. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 609 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 609 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Okay, Senator Telfer, would you like to carry this bill?
Certainly.
It's yours. Okay, that concludes our work sessions, and we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 563. Hi, Dave.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, you have, first of all, Senate Bill 563 directs all deposits of interest on late payment of property taxes to the so-called CAFA account, County Assessment Function Funding Assistance account, and the bill applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2013. Now, you have step measure summary and on top of the original bill, you have Dash 1 amendment. Actually, we needed Dash 1 amendment to accomplish the original intention of the bill. That is, all the collected interest on late payment of property taxes are eventually credited to County Assessment Function Funding Assessment Account. Now, as a way of background information, collected interest on late payment of property taxes are deposited and credited to first County Assessment and Taxation Fund. And these interest payments are turned over on a quarterly basis to the state, and a portion of which is distributed to the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance, so-called CAFA account, based on the formula in ORS Chapter 311-508. The CAFA fund is derived from a $9 recording fee at the county, and a portion of interest on late payment on property taxes, a portion of the interest on late payment on property taxes. The CAFA fund covers about 22% of the total cost for the county assessment and taxation function. In anticipation of cessation of federal forest payments to counties, the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services had recommended in its final report that all delinquent interest on property taxes be placed into the CAFA account. So this bill is related to that recommendation.
Okay, and this, the purpose is to make it pay more of its way, correct?
It's to support, to help alleviate the financial burden on the part of the counties.
Okay. All right. We have folks signed up, and I don't have my sign-up list, so Gil, let's start with you.
And that's
sit there or here? What's your preference? Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome. Thank you.
I am Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm accompanied by Annette Spickard, who is Lane County Assessor and current president of both the County Assessors Association and the Tax Collectors Association.
Okay.
You'll notice that there are two letters of support from two of the direct stakeholders in the property tax system, the League of Oregon Cities and the Special Districts Association of Oregon, for this concept. I must hasten, though, to add that the concept is not reflected in the amendments. Our intention was to have it operate straight away as opposed to in a delayed fashion.
What do you mean by that? You mean have it implemented sooner?
Yes.
Okay.
The bill was generated, as Mr. Beck said, from a Department of Revenue work group that met between October 2007 and January 2008, and it was made up of representatives of all the direct stakeholders in the property tax system. The immediate concern at that time was the impending expiration of the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000. A safety net like that was extended in October of 2008, but at smaller and diminishing levels, so that in the fourth year of its operation, 1 year before it expires, it will be some 40% of the payments that have been made to counties and schools in recent years. The funding for an array of state county shared services and county local services is still quite destable. The work group for DOR, among other things, agreed that all interest and delinquent property taxes should be placed into the CAFA. Now, full disclosure, as Mr. Beck mentioned, the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services took this as a recommendation, it's number 23, and said it should be adopted within 4 years, and our assertion is that we are within 4 years, of course, and it needs to be done now, and for reasons that I will explain. The county's role in property tax administration is critical. It assesses and collects revenues for education and local and state shared services. In biennial terms, it collects $4 billion for education. It collects nearly $2 billion for cities and over $1 billion for special districts. The state assessment and taxation funding program began in 1989 in response to the disintegration of the property tax system that was occurring then because of two primary causes, the recession and elimination of federal general revenue sharing. County governing bodies were forced to make drastic across-the-board cuts across all programs. I've attached a summary for later reference of the sharing program and its evolution over time. But to say in summary, the Department of Revenue supervises county administration and the CAFA, which provides some funds for county support. Qualifying counties are those that meet minimum statutory requirements for assessment and taxation and property tax administration. And they share funds proportionally based on DOR-approved A&T budgets. CAF is fed by three sources, as you heard, an assessor processing fee, a portion of delinquent property taxes, and a $5 million biennial appropriation from the state to partially compensate for county collections for the state school system. $515,000 of that was taken to rebalance the 07-09 budget, and we acknowledge that the appropriation that otherwise would come for 09-11 is at risk. The county revenue engine is beginning to sputter. In fact, Curry County in fiscal year 07-08 dropped into a program statutory dispensation at a level that permits them to operate at a level normally deemed less than adequate. A DOR study in 2004 found that the level of funding at that time, which I might note, the CAFA provided 32% of the funds in 2004, it now provides 22% of local funds for property tax administration. At that time, the Department of Revenue found that funding permitted most but not all the critical program requirements. Two that fell short were very important: active appraisal and finding omitted property. These are the two most important and effective ways to make sure all taxable properties on the roll. CAFA has not kept up with costs. Counties are in no position to backfill. Even though counties share a mere 19% statewide of property tax collections, for fiscal year 08-09, they have approved A&T budget statewide of $91.5 million. 22% of that represents CAFA contribution to local administration. The balance, therefore, is county general funds raised locally. County's financial system is dire, as documented by the governor's task force. County governing bodies are doing the best they can to keep up with A&T requirements, but they have to do a number of things, including fund an array of state-shared services that you've seen in this ubiquitous color table. They're hampered by measures 5 and 50, and they face a ramp down, which is depicted in the attachment, the bar chart, of the Federal Forest Payments Safety Net. The task force noted that at expiration of the federal safety net, there will be 24 hard-hit counties, 12 of which will be in condition critical, and 3 will be in condition unsustainable. The final attachment depicts the gap between annual county revenues and expenditures that exists now and continues to grow. There's no relief in sight. Again, counties cannot backfill the CAFA shortage. As revenues fall behind the needs, the local pressure will mount to protect human services and health services and public safety, matters potentially of life and death. We do not expect a local groundswell to support field appraisers in the assessor's office. For counties that cannot meet minimum A&T standards, the Department of Revenue will be forced to make an untenable choice, whether to withhold a CAFA grant and thereby virtually ensuring system failure. The system needs this incremental but necessary investment. It's a highly important element of repairing our sputtering revenue engine, which drives funding of essential public services. And I'd be happy to take questions or let Annette to show you a little bit about the A&T operation locally.
Why don't we have you give us the details and then we'll hold questions till then.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annette Spickard and president of the Assessors Association and the Tax Collectors Association this year and the assessor in Lane County. I put together a couple of slides and you should have a copy of my PowerPoint there for you for your reference. As you've heard already, property taxes obviously are a very important local revenue source for the cities, the schools, our special districts such as fire districts, library districts, for example, urban renewal, and it's a very stable and steady stream of revenue that they rely upon. And as you've heard, in 1 year, I put a one-year number here, but roughly $4 billion is collected statewide to fund all of those services for the public. And we all agree, especially at the task force that met in the interim, that having a current and accurate tax roll is very important, not only for the local governments to provide those services, but also to ensure that taxpayers are being taxed correctly and fairly. And as Gil explained, the cost to administer the state's property tax system at the local level has been built around a shared partnership where a portion's paid at the time real estate transactions and other things are recorded at the county clerk's office. And so in that way, the real estate industry participates. The county general fund, obviously, it's a county responsibility under the law, so they make a significant contribution. And then we have the CAFA program where we have a portion of the delinquent interest, and this is where the recording fee is allocated. And then back in 1999, the state also contributed $5 million per biennium to help support an adequate tax system. And currently that $5 million is part of a potential reduction from the DOR budget at Ways and Means for next biennium. So that's an additional concern for us. The way the CAFA fund is distributed, and this bill does not change the distribution method, but I thought you might want to know how it's spent right now. 10% off the top goes to the Department of Revenue for administration, and the remaining 90% is distributed to counties on a pro rata basis for the following allowable expenditures. So each year, about this time, actually, we individually certify to the Department of Revenue how many staff and how much we're going to spend and what the workload is in order to qualify for the money available under this program. And as Gil already mentioned, the Department of Revenue and state statute has strict standards that counties must comply with in order to participate in this program. And I guess we look at it as kind of a carrot and a stick approach. So we have a carrot in terms of a grant that's available to help offset some of the county's costs to do property tax assessment and collection. However, if the county is unable to meet the minimum standards, not only do they lose the money, but the Department of Revenue has the authority to take over certain functions for the county, do the work, and bill the county back for the cost to do the work. So as budgets keep getting tighter and tighter at the local level, and it's harder for county commissioners to fully fund the A&T function, there are a lot more conversations happening statewide about whether certain counties are actually going to be in the position of having to give A&T back to the state to handle. And so it's a very difficult conversation a lot of us are facing right now about whether we're going to have to go down that road. And as Gil mentioned, we had a couple of counties last year actually get very close to this. The Department of Revenue had serious conversations with Josephine County and Curry County and Coos County about potentially having to step in depending on what the county was able to provide locally, and they put them on sort of a like probation, I guess, where they're going to let them operate for a year under reduced circumstances, still participate in CAFA, but they need to get things back in shape pretty quick. So this is an example of the original cost sharing that happened the first year CAFA was put into place. The account paid for 22% of the statewide costs, and the counties picked up 78%. This most current year that we're in right now, we're at an 81 to 19% split, and it fluctuates from year to year. Some years it was as high as like 32%, I believe, but it's been on a steady decline because none of the revenue sources into CAFA are indexed in any way. Here is what we spend the money on. In the first year, you can see the split for the qualifying expenses. And one of the things that'll be interesting, what I find interesting, is back before Measure 50, we spent, you know, 45% of our effort on appraisal. We were still doing cyclical reappraisal efforts and visiting all the properties, a sixth of all the county each year. This current year, here's the breakdown of how we dedicate our resources to meet the minimum standards. And if you look at the yellow pie, records actually is with the records management and having to deal with Measure 50 management as well. And so we spend a lot more time on that piece of the tax system now, and there's no longer a requirement for cyclical reappraisal, so we don't go out and just inspect every property all the time anymore. We're very narrowly focused on inspecting new construction, new subdivisions, any new properties that need to be added to the tax roll or have had some kind of change. So that's been kind of a shift since Measure 50 was adopted. This chart shows you over time how the delinquent interest contribution, which is the bottom portion of the bar, and the recording fee contribution to CAPA have behaved over time. It's fairly stable, fairly flat in terms of the delinquent interest amount. And as you can see, the recording fee is much more volatile, and right now they're projecting the 08 column is the projection from the DOR economists on what they think this year will end up as. But you can see recording fees are definitely down. This is just showing the growth in expense statewide for the whole property tax system over time, and this is the portion that the counties are covering that's not covered through the CAFA grant. And so it's definitely putting pressure on the counties, and they have little flexibility because many of us are at the minimum staffing standards now, and so trying to right size or adjust that level on an annual basis is getting harder and harder because a lot of us have already reduced our budgets in the past. This is just a comparison of the delinquent interest that's been deposited each year. And the tall bar is just the cost to do the appraisal work for new construction and appraisal activities, and the, combined with the cost of tax collection for the districts, just to kind of give you a visual of how much the delinquent interest contributes, because this is interest that otherwise would have been paid to all of the taxing districts. So the taxing districts are paying some share now of the property tax system. Right now, we have a two-tiered system to determine how much of the delinquent interest gets put into this account. The first calculation is 25% of everything, and it applies to everybody. And then we do a second calculation of another 25%, but we exclude school districts and the counties from that portion. And Senate Bill 563 proposes eliminating this tiering concept and instead just having all of the interest placed into the CAPA account to be redistributed back to the counties. Here's an example from my own county. We have 82 tax districts that I collect for annually $379 million. Of that, in 2008, for example, the amount of delinquent interest that was paid to all those districts after we did that split for the CAFA fund was $130,000. So this gives you an idea of if we switch to 100% of the interest going into CAFA, this is the amount in Lane County that would have gone to CAFA instead of to the districts, for example. And 1 year was $130,000. And about half of that would have been related to schools. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but the result from the work that was done in the interim task force showed that the revenue sources for CAFA haven't kept pace with the expenses, and we're required to meet minimum staffing standards by the state DOR, and this is just one idea that may be of interest to the state and to the governor, hopefully, that can help with covering our expenses and keeping some stability in the future. And we would use the same mechanism that's in place now for distributing that revenue. There's no change to the actual allocation process or anything. It's just a change to the incoming revenue that's being proposed. And I'm happy to answer any questions or give you any examples of what happened in Lane County when we fell behind in our keeping our tax roll current.
Actually, I would like to find that out, but first, tell me, I think maybe I'm just slow today, but this bill would put the money directly in the CAFA account where it would stay and be distributed, whereas before it was collected and then paid to the Department of Revenue quarterly. How did that work?
What happens right now is as we collect the late payments, the treasurer of the county will split a portion of the interest when we collect it and put some into the, it's called CATF, the County Assessment and Taxation Fund, which is how it gets to the DOR. And then the other portion is paid out to the districts as usual with their regular proceeds. And once the DOR has collected money from all the counties through that process, then each quarter they pay a portion back to the county general fund to pay for A&T. So it's kind of a way to equalize. Instead of each county keeping the interest they collect themselves, we all put it into a pot, and then it's pro rata split across the state based on the cost of our departments.
And Madam Chair, the Department of Revenue keeps 10% of CAFA for its responsibilities under the law.
Okay, so this would just shorten the journey that the money takes, correct?
Madam Chair, what would happen is instead of splitting the interest at the time of collection and giving some to the districts and some to the DOR for this grant program, we would just give it all to the DOR for the grant program, so that the local level, the taxing districts would be foregoing that revenue.
And I see from the testimony here from the special districts that they're okay with this.
Indeed, Madam Chair, so are the League of Cities.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Anybody else want to talk on this bill?
Madam Chair,
Senator Morris?
Before our guests leave, I do have a question. Is it possible to have a kind of a broad summary of the assessment and taxation costs associated to the counties and the same costs, type of costs, administration of DOR, and then where the monies go on a distributed basis? And I guess what's behind my question is the greatest part of the responsibility lies at the local level. Are you getting revenue commensurate to your percentage of responsibility? If that makes any sense to you.
Vice Chair Morris, I might mention that when this concept was instituted in 1989, we had assumed that the sharing would be 35% to 40% from the CAFA, and as Annette mentioned, we got to 32%, but as the costs have grown and CAFA has receded, the gap is now very wide. Clarification, though, you're looking for the duties done at the local level versus those at DOR and the relative costs of each?
Well, Madam Chair, you referenced the beginning point where you thought you were having the distribution, and now it's something less than that. Is the distribution equitable to the levels of responsibility and functions that you have?
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I that's a policy question. I would argue that it's not. The counties collect 46% of what they collect goes to education. And this, what we're suggesting with this concept is that some of that, is that delinquent interest go to help continue to collect the $4 billion that we do every biennium for education. It's an investment. I think it would be a wise investment, particularly nowadays with you've seen the local gap counties between expenses and revenues and how it's growing. So the concept is we would like to see CAFA provide more funds, have it closer to the kind of work that to the extent of work that counties provide for other districts. Now we statewide we keep 19% of the property tax revenues, and yet we're paying 78% of the cost of raising it and collecting it.
Okay, actually, why don't you tell us what happened to Lane County when you fell below your standards.
Madam Chair, sure. Lane County, back in the 80s, was one of the counties that took severe reductions in the staff of the A&T office, along with a lot of other departments at the county as a result of recession and loss of timber funds back then. And I believe they cut the department size in about half. And then again in the mid-90s, when Measure 50 was implemented, the assessor's office again reduced their staff significantly as part of the budget cutbacks countywide. What happened was we ended up with a chronic backlog, 36 months roughly backlog in getting new tax accounts set up on the tax roll. So, for example, someone would divide their property, and it would take sometimes up to 3 years before the office had that second parcel on the tax roll and a correct tax statement going to those owners. And this was a major problem, not only for the taxpayers, but also for the financing end of the business if they were trying to sell that piece of land to somebody else, and there was no tax statement for it or tax account set up yet for it, and it created a lot of problems in that respect, along with the fact that they weren't paying tax on it either. It was still being taxed under the original description. So what happened was we did an audit and determined in 2004, based on all the work that hadn't been completed and put onto the tax roll, that there were roughly, I think, 3,500 properties that needed to be added. We were foregoing about $4.5 million in tax revenue each year by not having them on the roll. We had significant issues, I think, with the mortgage companies and such and the taxpayers. And the Department of Revenue helped us in terms of identifying some strategies around getting that back on track. But also through the requirements of the CAFR program and meeting those minimum standards and kind of the stick approach of what happens if you don't meet their standards, we were able to come to agreement with the county commissioners. They made an investment in some additional staff with us, and now we're caught up. So it was very successful. We were able to get all of those properties added to the roll and keep up with all the new construction, all the new business that was going on in the county. And we were able to demonstrate the revenue results for all the districts, and it really helped out also at the local level with the real estate industry. They were quite pleased to have all that caught up. So there definitely is a risk to the districts if the A&T system starts falling behind again, because it does equate to lost revenue in those tax years where we don't get everything done. And I think that's why they were interested in what little help might be available through this bill, because it is in their interest that we're able to collect for them. And now that we have a lot of local option levies in place for a lot of these districts, that revenue source is really dependent upon the real market value of the property. And so they definitely need us to be doing as good a job as possible in order to generate the local option revenue. And for schools, that's outside of the state school fund formula. So that's additional money they get without state assistance. So,
Madam Chair, a couple of parenthetical comments. The Lane County was our poster child in 1989 when this was initially instituted, and that was back in the levy-based system. Now you find property under the rate-based system. You find property that's off the roll if you have the staff to go out and find it, and it's additional revenue for schools and all the other taxing districts.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the hearing. Anybody else want to talk on this? John, did you want to say something? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I was just thinking about Senator Morris, your question, and perhaps there was a gap in some of the explanation. We weren't maybe focusing as much on what the 10% went to, and I was just wondering if that's where your question was going. What does the department do with the 10%, or how is that allocation that was set back when, is that still appropriate? Is that where you were going, if I might ask?
Yes.
Okay.
Because that's really the only issue to talk about, probably outside the scope of this bill, is that 10%. Is it,
and
is,
I just,
is the distribution of responsibility and the funds to carry those out equitable. That's, I guess, what's okay. behind my question.
Thank you, and I'll just try to explain a little bit about that, and that the department does appraise all the industrial properties in the state that over $1 million, and we also appraise all utility companies, which in our definition is the railroad and the gas and the telephone communication and all of that. So the 10% that we take, or up to 10%, goes to fund the appraisal functions that then we turn that value over to the county, and then they bill it and do the collection. So our role is in that. And I think there's been discussion about, well, will the state take all the personal property in the state and collect that too and value it? So there's been discussions about maybe what we're doing is a good idea, and the decisions that were made back in 89 to say, will the department take on the industrial appraisal, for example? And that's where the 10% came from, and that I think that's been a successful move. Haven't heard anybody talking about going back the other way or reallocating that, but we can look more into it if you'd like us to pursue that.
Well, I think this discussion is adequate.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad you came up, because I had misunderstood your question as well. I thought you were talking about equity among the counties.
No, yeah. Between DOR and
right.
the counties.
That's right. What I thought. Thank you.
Thank you for doing that, John.
Sure.
Any other questions before he leaves? Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 563. And finally, Mazin, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 300. Get back to some bites on this committee.
Bites?
Yeah. Oh. Anytime Mazin comes, you know it's about some bites or other.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, today, Senate Bill 300 is basically about creating the Tabasco Task Force.
No, Mazin, it's not Tabasco.
I
will not stand for you including Tabasco as a vice. I will not stand for it.
Well, I thought I'll say that it's since it's April Fool's Eve. So it's a Tabasco Task Force.
There you go.
Okay. And it goes through the discussion of the task force and the members and what it does, and it's supposed to draw on resources from departments and so on. However, the bill as it stands, Madam Chair, was actually a very convenient bill to do some kind of rescue job because of its relating clause. The relating clause of the bill is about taxation and appropriating money. And we were looking for issues that were with the Department of Revenue tobacco program. Well, that tobacco program was suggesting to have certain abilities instituted in the law from their search in some of the stores and places that they inspect. And we were looking at that time in House Bill 2048. However, because the amendments needed in House Bill 2048 did not work with the relating clause, we're using this Senate Bill 300 in order to do that. So you would find this in the Dash 1 amendment, and the Dash 1 amendment in front of you talk about the level for the Department of Revenue when it is going into distribution places or sale and distribution places for tobacco and cigarettes, and how that process will allow the inspectors for the Department of Revenue to go into places that otherwise the law does not allow them to go into. So that's the first issue that this bill would deal with. The second issue comes from House Bill 2160, which is also another salvage process for the Department of Revenue. As you know, the Department of Revenue at this time has been going with different way of funding. This is the tobacco program in the Department of Revenue. And the tobacco program, unlike all other programs, gets its appropriation or used to get its appropriation from the general fund, and then it collects for the tobacco, which is the revenue is used for a whole different number of programs. This includes the tobacco reduction, OHP, cities, counties, and also the public transit. The way by which the funding is to happen is through the general fund appropriation. This Dash 2 amendment, or House Bill 2160, what it would suggest is that the Department of Revenue tobacco program would start be getting a continuous appropriation from the revenue that is being collected for tobacco. So it's off the top, it takes, and then after it pays for the costs of collection, after paying the cost of collection, you would go and distribute the revenues to the different distribution that is in the statutes. This is consistent with all the other programs that occur in the state. This is how most of the collection costs are paid for in the different areas. However, that needs to be continuously appropriated, and then they would go to the Ways and Means Committee and get a limitation on the appropriation of their tasks. So that what you would see in the Dash 2 amendment, basically twice talking about the continuous appropriation for the Department of Revenue. Finally, Madam Chair, the members of the committee, the Dash 3 is pretty close to what the Dash 1 is. The difference is that it allows for what is civil penalties, and you'd find that in the second and third page. This is on line 20 to 21 on the second page, and line 25 on the third page. It allows for those to be used by the department in order to be able to have, if you will, a small stick as well as a carrot for entering these places. This just came at the time of the start of the hearing, so we were not able to include it in your background in the SMS, but that is what it does.
So the Dash 3, again, is the same content as the Dash 1, but it allows penalties.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. I think we can deal with that. Okay. We have two people signed up, Sean Miller and Deborah Buchanan.
Me to begin? Okay. Madam Chairman, the Chairwoman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. I was here to support the Dash 3 amendments until I found out this was a Tabasco tax. I will just briefly just summarize the work that's been done on the Dash, actually the Dash 1 and the Dash 3, and I think the Dash 3, as was indicated, does have a penalty provision in it. But this came out of a work group that was put together in the interim by Representative Schaffler and the House Business and Labor Committee, where they did look at tobacco tax compliance. And we did discover in those meetings that the Department of Revenue doesn't have the authority to inspect the entire premises of someone who sells tobacco. And what that means is in particular cases in grocery stores, you have a service center that's normally used behind the counter that sells tobacco. And in those cases, the compliance of that, when someone comes in and inspects to look at tobacco tax compliance, they have the ability to inspect in that area, and that's it. And there was cases, I think, by the Attorney General's Office, Department of Revenue, that was outlined in these work groups that the folks that are actually selling the non-compliant cigarettes, things that do not have a tobacco stamp on it, would be doing this out of a back room or a locked room where they would not have the ability to inspect. Now, the OLCC alcohol inspections has the ability to inspect the entire premises. So we kind of, our belief is if someone's inspecting and trying to and doing something illegally, that they should have the ability to inspect the entire premises. And so we did support the concept of having Department of Revenue person comes in like they do now, give them the ability to inspect the entire premises. And that's what the bill does. And the Dash 3 amendments, line 16, it basically talks about the inspection operated at the premises regardless of whether patrons are permitted to be present in those areas. And then it goes on to describe those areas, whether it's a locked room or even a storeroom out back. Those areas would be under and allowed for inspection. So, again, from our perspective, from the grocery industry's perspective, that are doing things legally, tax compliance, folks that are not doing it legally, it's an unfair competitive advantage, obviously, in selling these products. And so we would like to have give the Department of Revenue the tools to be able to get those people. And we feel that this bill does, or the amendment does. And again, the bill was House Bill 2048. Unfortunately, the amendments that we worked out did not fit the relating clause. And so that's why we have the amendment to go into this bill relating to taxation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Deborah?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I will not repeat what Mr. Miller said about the Dash 1 and the Dash 3 amendments, but would speak to the Dash 2 amendments, which deal with funding for the department. Mm-hmm. As staff explained, this does restore it to what it used to be several years ago, where the funding is taken from the stream of revenues from the cigarette tax and other tobacco products tax. The reason that we feel that this is important is it does allow the legislature to be more flexible and to respond to compliance issues that come up during the interim. For example, we received a number of letters or reports of internet sales of cigarettes during the interim. We didn't have the resources to respond to those, but because you were here in session in February of 2008, we came here and were able to receive funding for that so we could go ahead and process those pieces of information and do that work. So this would allow us, again, to be more flexible and respond quickly to compliance issues that come up during the interim. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and the reason for that is that you'd have a funding stream.
Yes, Madam Chair, with the limitation as mentioned.
Okay. I want to thank you for working, Sean, with folks and understanding it's in everyone's best interest to get the bad actors out of the out of the picture. So thank you for doing that. Any questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
I just declaring a potential conflict in that, just to be on the record, that I have a business partner who's probably one of your larger payer of tobacco tax in the state. So
an honest one, I'm sure.
Very honest, very honest. She's also a client, so as a CPA, keep her honest.
Okay, thank you for that declaration. That will be made part of the record. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you for your work on this.
Thank you. We will
bring this back. It is a fabulous relating clause when you think about it. Okay. Anybody else want to talk about this bill? Okay. We're done with our work, and I will remind the committee again about our deadline. Anything that's going to be posted for work session has to be posted by April 17th. Is it 17th or 18th?
17th.
And our last work, anything that's going to come out, any Senate bill that's going to come out of this committee has to be out by April 28th. We are one of the committees that doesn't have strict adherence to the deadlines, but it's my intent to get them out unless there's some bigger picture extenuating circumstance. So with that, we are adjourned.